Just how creative are you feeling now? On a scale of 1 to 100, I'd say I'm about 72.5, possibly even 73.7. But it has to be said, that's a wild guess. For something so incredibly important, creativity seems to have evaded nearly every attempt to measure it. We're obsessed by testing and measuring everything else, but there seems to be no Richter scale whatsoever for good ideas. There might be very soon, though. Today, I'll be talking to psychologists and businesses to find out if it can be measured, tested, observed, manipulated, and even improved. Applied creativity is a hot subject, even at government level. The Chancellor Gordon Brown recently commissioned a review of creativity in business and how it might improve productivity. It's not just in business, though. One researcher is now trying to bring brain science into the classroom to monitor children's creativity levels. And even poets nowadays think you can use precise strategies to boost your imagination. Andrew Motion is Poet Laureate and Professor of Creative Writing at the Royal Holloway College in London. He offered me some tips.
Keep your eyes open, keep your ears open. Keep some time to yourself, thinking time to yourself. Have the courage to take your mind in directions that it hasn't been in before. Read. Read, travel, listen to people on the bus, listen to people on the tube. Join in life, but look at it from an angle. Realise that you are the only person who is you, and that what you're hearing and seeing from the most exalted philosophical speculation that you might have about it, down to the actual colours, are unique to you, and that if you can see them clearly and write them down accurately, you're well on your way to being creative.
More tips now from leading crime writer P.D. James.
Nearly everyone has some creative ability, and I think people know where their creativity is, and the great thing is, you know, to develop it, to use it, to enjoy it. There are things you need to do in just reading widely, trying to learn from the best without copying them, and going through life with all your senses open to experience. All these things matter, but I just think find out what is creative in yourself. And develop it, and above all, enjoy it.
Do you think creativity makes people happy? Does it make you happy?
Oh, yes, undoubtedly it does. I think this is part of being a happy human being, to create. Absolutely.
Today, I'll be attempting to solve the mystery of creativity. I'll be asking whether we can really map and manipulate this fugitive phenomenon and truly harness its elusive energy. But it's not the easiest of subjects. It seems to slip in between academic disciplines and defy definitions. Adrian Furnham is Professor of Psychology at University College London.
People have long been interested in creativity, and from many different disciplines. Anthropologists and art historians and scientists have been interested in creativity. And I suppose that the social sciences, specifically psychology, probably right from the beginning. The psychologists who are what are known as differential psychologists, those who are interested in individual differences, at the turn of the century became interested in intelligence and creativity and personality. And so I suppose as a scientific enterprise, it's about 100 years old, but alas, there hasn't been as much progress in creativity as there has been in other areas.
But creativity is increasingly being studied as an academic discipline in its own right. And businesses nowadays actively want to recruit creative people. All the more reason to develop a reliable method of measuring it. A sort of IQ test with knobs on. Mark Beatty from University College London is one of the few researchers in the UK currently trying to get to grips with its complexities.
Creativity traditionally has been defined in terms of single measurement, divergent thinking, creative personality. The way the field seems to be moving now is to look at it much more in terms of something that's made up of multiple components, or perhaps a syndrome. In effect, what we're arguing is that there isn't a single underlying factor, component in the human being that makes them creative. Rather, it's the interaction between their intellectual abilities, their personal outlook on the world, how they are motivated, the confidence, and also the environment they find themselves in that determines their creative output.
But there is one test of creative output already in existence. The Torrance test has been around for decades, and it asks all sorts of odd questions like, what would it be like if clouds had strings hanging from them? Very peculiar, I'd have thought. But as Mark said, creativity is not just about having absurd ideas about cumulonimbuses. It's about the subtleties of personality, your particular style of thinking. To test my creativity, holistically, Mark gave me a vast questionnaire, asking me not about clouds and strings, but about my motivation, confidence, personality and tolerance of diversity and ambiguity. It was then time to do some tests on the divergentness of my thinking.
The first test is your ability to produce as many ideas as you can, or as many words beginning with the letter B.
Be a moth. Be a bean. Bumblebee. Bipolar. Bring. Blessing. Benediction. Bruises. Bottom. Oh, sorry. how did I do them?
The average number of responses is about 22. I think you did slightly over that. So to a certain extent, what we can say is that your ability to be fluent, to produce lots of ideas from a simple stimulus, the way your brain, how efficient your brain is at retrieving information that makes sense to a set rule, is of a high quality, which would feed into your ability to produce lots of ideas. Now, the second test, we're becoming increasingly more complicated. In this case, I'd like you to try and list as many unusual uses that you can think of as possible for a brick.
Obviously to build a house. You could put it on the bottom of your shoes to have permanent exercise. You could use it as an objet d'art. You could sell it to Tate Modern and say that it's a throwback, a kind of modern minimalist take on those original bricks. You could kill somebody.
The last test I'm going to give to you is what's called the consequences test. Now, the example I'd like you to try and produce as many ideas as possible for is, can you imagine what the consequences would be if everybody suddenly woke up with an extra leg?
Tony Blair would declare a state of emergency, probably, and there would be a kind of extra leg cabinet meeting. Would it make driving easier? I'm not sure. I don't drive, so I'm not sure, but it probably would.
Taking the results from the divergent thinking tests you've just done and some of the tests that I was able to give you earlier, we are able to build up something of a profile. You reported yourself, or you perceived yourself, to be someone who's particularly open, which means that you're sort of a person who has flights of fancy, you're open to new ideas, new ways of doing things. You're also someone who's particularly stable, you're not particularly open to worry, which means you'll stick at a project for a long time. Putting that together with how you reported yourself to experience ideas, you said that you were someone who was particularly flexible in their thinking. If I was to put those all together, your style is a generalist mixture of being scientific, so lots of hard work, but also very artistic at the same time. You have the ability to produce ideas in both artistic and scientific ways, and you will have the confidence to express those ideas with other people. So I would say, if I had to put my head on the line, that yes, you were a creative person.
Oh, excellent. Thank you very much. Adrian Furnham admits it's a very complex area, and being creative isn't just about having a prolific and liberal personality.
As well as having this particular profile, one needs some sort of ability. It might be painting ability, it might be general knowledge, it might be technical skill. Nearly everyone who has been very creative has always astounded one by their brilliance at some activity, by their intellectual brilliance, by their painting skill or whatever.
So, psychologists can measure creativity, at least up to a point, depending on how you define it. But some scientists reckon they can now watch creative thinking as it happens physically inside your head, observe your brain in action, and spy on how creative your thinking really is, precisely and objectively. This could have a huge impact on teaching if it was used in the classroom. Teachers could literally see inside their students' heads and monitor how they're responding to creative techniques and strategies. Paul Howard Jones is an educational psychologist at Bristol University. He's researching the neuroscience of education. I met him at Exeter University's Medical Imaging Unit. His research into creative strategies was inspired by the eccentric early ecologist Kurt Schwitters.
The reason why I'm interested in Kurt Schwitters is because he used strategies which we are beginning to have some sort of insight into. One of the things he did, for example, was he would make collages out of found objects. He would decide, I'm going to make a collage out of objects arising from, for example, my wife's waste paper bin. He didn't know what he was going to find when he went in that bin, picks them out, tries to put them together in something which is meaningful for him. He's trying to find links, whether they're visual links or conceptual links, to create this collage. Now, that interests me because that's a strategy. Why can't all of us use strategies like that and make ourselves more creative?
In the absence of a small child, he used me as his guinea pig and gave me typical classroom tasks that an English teacher might inflict on pupils. Telling stories using unrelated, random words. Would it really work? Would it actually fire off the creative bits of my brain, so to speak? Before he put me in a brain scanner, he explained the task in hand, which involved random words, connected words, and me trying to be either creative or deliberately uncreative.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a task. The task is going to be to make up a story, to think up a storyline for a novel or a plot or something. Sometimes you're going to be making up the story, sometimes we're going to be asking you to be creative, and sometimes we're going to be asking you to be uncreative. And also, we're going to be varying how related the words are.
And what's your expectation? Do you reckon where will my stories become more creative, do you think?
I think when you're using the unrelated words, you're going to find that, in fact, you are producing something that the rest of us, even though we know you're using those words, are going to rate as more creative.
So how do you actually see what's going on inside my head when that happens?
When we've got your results and we've shown that this strategy and your personal effort can vary your creativity, then we're going to put you into an MRI scanner and we're going to do a functional scan, an fMRI scan. That stands for functional magnetic resonance imaging. And the idea is that where there's increased blood flow in your brain, there's a likelihood of increased cognitive activity.
Now into the apparatus, where I was about to relay my stories through a speaker for all to judge as I watched the stimulus words flash up on a mirror.
What we're going to do now is actually just draw the cylinder over your head until there's a little mirror.
It's starting to feel like a budgie. I've got my head inside a cage and I'm looking into a mirror.
What you're going to have to do is you're going to have about 20 seconds to think up your story, and then there'll be a command that says, please tell us your story.
Block one, please be very creative with the following sets of words. Get ready. Skirt burst fever. The skirting boards burst. And out of the skirting boards came a whole load of mice, and suddenly they did a routine from Saturday Night Fever, and nobody knew what was happening. Legs, sieve, melon. A picture of Nigella Lawson here is strange.
My stories were given creativity scores by a panel of teachers in the room next door. Then I did the experiment while my brain was scanned, and Paul showed me the images later of my brain recorded when I was spinning my most creative yarns.
The last image that I want to show you, Ian, is probably the one that's most interesting. This is showing you the activity which is associated with creativity and creative effort. The hot spot here is in the right front medial gyrus and a bit towards the anterior cingulate as well. This part of the brain, which is active when you're using a strategy, is about increasing the amount of control that you're applying. In other words, you are consciously working harder to maintain control over the process. If you think about it, those three words that are unrelated could be combined in all sorts of different ways, and you were probably spinning through all those different ways as quickly as possible, but chucking out the ones that just didn't make sense.
So at this point in the creative process, the crucial point, we're actually doing lots of very sharp, hard thinking. We're filtering out, we're editing.
Yeah. So although the strategy itself sounds pretty wild, and, you know, we have this image of the surrealists as being a pretty sort of bohemian bunch, in actual fact, to get the best out of the strategy, to be creative with it, it actually looks from this brain scan that it requires more control.
So in the future, English teachers, say, might be able to check the effectiveness of their creative writing lessons by looking inside their pupils' brains. If a strategy like random word linking works, then the appropriate bits will light up. The Romantic poets would probably have disapproved of this talk of strategy, but they had plenty of strategies of their own.
John Keats, for instance, used to pretend to himself, when he got stuck, used to pretend to himself that he was going out, and he'd put on smart clothes and retie his shoelaces. He talks about this in one of his letters. And get as far as the front door and then whip round and go back to his desk and sit down and try and catch the muse by surprise.
Nowadays, business people stay at their desks and pay for their muses to come to them. They employ creativity consultants, the personal trainers of the world of ideas.
Sebastian Bailey is director of the Mind Gym, a company which helps business people think outside their business box. And, like Paul Howard Jones, he uses a lot of random stimulation. He asked me to solve the problem of traffic congestion, creatively, by listening to random noises. To be honest, at first, I was feeling a bit sheepish. It's a couple of sheep having a really bad argument. I'm not sure what they're talking about, but it's just obviously a contentious sheep subject.
So again, how can we link that sound back to our objective of reducing congestion? What does that make you think of?
Well, transport involving sheep, or people following other people like sheep. What do sheep do? Wool, to be more woolly in the way we think about transport, to give people woolly jumpers.
What I was thinking was, apart from something you said, which is that sheep all tend to head in the same direction. So you could argue traffic flow is one thing, but what about kind of compulsory hitchhiking? So if you're travelling past someone, you know, they've got a board kind of saying that this is where I want to go, and you get into the car with them, and you've got to pick up two or three hitchhikers on your way into work or back again, as long as they're kind of headed in the same direction.
We've come up with some preposterous ideas.
Absolutely.
Here. Can we ever really honestly use any of them?
I think that there's an awful lot we can't use, but there may be two or three ideas in here that we can work up, that we can modify a little bit, and then we can actually go on and implement them. So I suppose the question is, if we were going to make compulsory hitchhiking work, what would we need to do?
What about some sort of trust system involving the internet or whatever, a sort of eBay sort of thing where you get stars for being a trustworthy driver or trustworthy hitchhiker?
So you could show your ID card and have your, you know, number of stars and your hitchhike rating as part of it?
I think, is it doable? Really, honestly, is it doable?
I don't know. I mean, probably want to investigate a little bit more, really think through what are the pros and cons of these different things, what are the potential dangers, and do some consultation, go to a number of different individuals and say, would this work, would you get into someone else's car, would you not? As a driver, would you be prepared to pick someone up? And begin to get some idea of the feasibility of it.
All that from a bunch of sheep having a panic attack. Time to drop in on another company which offers a creative service. The Silver Bullet Machine Manufacturing Company. Managing Director Dennis Sherwood believes there's very little mystery in creativity. It's simply about sitting down and making yourself think in a way that forces you to generate ideas.
What we address is the process of how to have an idea absolutely deliberately. So you and I can go into this room, and in 3 hours' time, we can absolutely guarantee a host of great ideas coming out of that process. Now, most people believe that that's not the way it happens, that you have to be sitting in the bath or strolling around the park and then the idea goes like that. Well, it can do that, and we rejoice in that, but you can't run a business based on that. You can't run an organisation based on that. It has to be much more deliberate. So I and my colleagues have designed a number of processes to make the process of idea generation absolutely deliberate, systematic, transferable, repeatable and safe. Here's an example which is kind of real. If you take bottled water, how would you describe bottled water? Notice, for example, that you drink bottled water. That's what you do with it. Notice, for example, that the top, the cap of the bottled water is flat. Those might seem very banal observations. But if you've noticed that the cap of the bottle is flat and you just have that little spirit of inquiry, it doesn't have to be like that, how might it be different? This is what might happen. You might say, well, it could be a cone, it could be a sphere, it could be a fancy shape, or it could be a dimple, a cone in reverse. As soon as you notice that it might be a dimple, you can say, what might I put in that dimple? Because I've made another container. You might say, I could put whiskey in there, whiskey and water together, nice idea. But you might say, I could put two aspirin in there. So that if I've got a headache and I go into the pharmacist at the station, I buy a combined twin pack of two aspirin and bottled water, where the aspirin are in the dimple in the top of the water packet. How did you get that idea? Totally deliberately. It was driven by observing the top was flat, imagining it might be something else, and discovering the dimple and saying, what might I do with that dimple? And that's a totally deliberate process, and it works time and time again.
I'd personally like to put a bee in the dimple and call it Jonathan Dimple Bee. On that note, Adrian Furnham is slightly waspish, not about Dennis and his dimples, but about the creativity industry in general.
I think a huge number of people try and exploit the concept that you can teach creativity. there's, as far as I can see, I've never seen a course called Teach Yourself to Become More Intelligent. Although people like to believe, A, that creativity is teachable, and B, that they can get better at it. I think creativity, like every other human characteristic, is normally distributed, like height. There are some tall people and some short people, and a lot of us are average. And that's true of almost every human characteristic, and creativity is like that. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't become more creative. You can read de Bono's books, and you can learn some of his tricks. And this means that a person at a certain level can become a little better and a little more imaginative and a little whatever, but not a great deal.
Dennis argues it's important to demystify creativity and to realise we can all become at least armchair Picassos.
There are two things going on with art. One is the imagination of Picasso's paintings at Guernica or Demoiselles d'Avignon, just imagining that in your mind. Then there's the execution of being able to do that rather well. Now, actually, I would argue that we can all do the imagination bit. I am absolutely convinced that no one is embargoed from having the ideas. Whether anyone wishes to have the ideas or can be bothered to think of the ideas, that's another matter. But I definitely believe that there is no human attribute that actually stops the mental process of being able to conjure up the idea in the first place. If we can all have the kind of ideas that Picasso had, if we wish to, whether or not we're in a position to execute them, that's another matter altogether.
I do not think you can train creativity. I think you have to have, number one, you have to have the gift, that is the ability to express those ideas. I think Picasso's imagination and many other artists' imaginations is extraordinary. You can look at his pictures, the great Guernica, for instance, and look at that picture for hours, and there's no way the average person would think of expressing it in that particular way. And the meanings that you can read into that, that is an extraordinary imagination and an extraordinary gift to execute that imagination. That cannot be taught. I'm convinced of that.
Here's a little song for anyone who's ever hated, in the key of grrr.
You certainly need an extraordinary imagination to think up a classic commercial. But do so-called advertising creatives, the people who dream up adverts, have a gift, or just a bunch of clever strategies, or perhaps both? Michael Russoff of ad agency Wieden & Kennedy is one of the people responsible for the award-winning Honda advert, featuring the song Hate Something, Change Something, not to mention a flying diesel engine and an enormous cast of rabbits, flamingos and peacocks. His strategy for creativity is not to think too hard.
Hate something, change something, make something better.
It's almost like focusing but not focusing. I think when you have a lightness to your mind, then you can like rest your mind on a problem. You can watch yourself watching it, kind of thing. And often I notice when I am under pressure, I get up very early in the morning and sit down and write. And it's almost like the first thing I do. So I might get up at 5, 6 o'clock and just write for an hour. And it's kind of when I'm not completely awake yet. And there's a kind of state that my mind goes into where I'm not sort of censoring myself at that point. And I find that very difficult to do at other times. And the Honda, the Grr, Hate Something, Change Something ad, I mean, starts from when we looked into the Honda diesel, the engine, and the story of Kenichi Nagihiro, who was their chief designer, and who'd been asked to design diesel engines but hated them. And that seemed like a very interesting place to start from.
That was your raw material, really.
Yeah, so that story was a story from Honda. And then at 6 o'clock in the morning, actually, I wrote the Hate Something, Change Something line, which was kind of like in the hypnagogic state. I was writing a load of stuff. In fact, I've still got the Word document, and there was a lot of different bits on that piece of paper. So I just kind of write. So there was, you know, whole pages of these things. And one of them was Hate Something, Change Something.
And were you thinking hard, or was it this lightness of touch?
No,
tell me about how you were thinking.
Just like you'd hold something gently. Enough tension for you not to fall asleep, but not enough for you to be thinking hard.
We recorded that chat in a padded cell, an actual padded cell next to Michael's office, built to inspire creativity and oddness. Down the corridor, there's also an oak-panelled library, much like one in a gentleman's club. There's also a drum kit and a mannequin in the reception, announcing Walk-in Stupid every morning. Many researchers have concluded that setting is vital to boosting creativity. American economics guru Professor Richard Florida has even developed a creativity index for cities and put the most gay-friendly and most ethnically diverse cities at the top. Manchester was the UK's number one. But if you don't live in Manchester and you're not planning on moving there, what practical things can you do to boost your personal creativity quotient?
If you want to be more creative, starting point is believe that you can do it. Because if you don't believe you can do it, forget it. So have belief. It's not magic. You don't have to be born Einstein or Picasso. Second thing is realise that creativity is not a bolt from the blue. It's not the strike of lightning. What it is about the discovery of a new pattern of things that are already out there, which are just combined together into a nice harmonious whole. How do you do that? Three things. Observe, observe, observe. Notice things. Imagine how those things might be different and allow yourself, give yourself permission to ask the question. Those are the key things.
Make time for yourself to sit at your desk, obviously, but also make time for what Keats so wonderfully called delicious, diligent indolence, staring off time, time that you don't have to account for, time when you're dredging through your mind, seeing what's there and sending it off on adventures to see what might be there. Don't shut yourself in an ivory tower. Go out into the world, mix with people, and give yourself permission to feel that this is a very, very important thing to be doing. But there was quite a long time when I used to try and coax myself into writing by drinking Lemsip, because I'd noticed that the poet A.E. Hasman, whom I greatly admire, wrote nearly all the great poems in Shropshire Lad when he had a cold, and I thought maybe if I could trick my body into feeling that I'd got one of those colds that isn't a complete flattener, but one of the ones that allows you to feel slightly sort of sorry for yourself in an interesting way, that it might help me write poems. I watch quite a lot of detective fiction on telly, that kind of thing. Yeah. Midsummer Murders, Poirot, things which require at the most about half of my mind.
The quest to test, measure, and physically locate creative thinking is only just beginning. And in the not-too-distant future, we might have a sort of creativity genome map. Of course, the assumption here is that creativity is a good thing. But should we all aspire to it? And if we did all become Picassos, would the world necessarily be a better, happier place?
Why is creativity so wonderful? What's the opposite of creativity? Well, you could say creativity is non-creative. On the other hand, you could say it's impractical. You could say, you know, there are individuals who are practical, down-to-earth, sensible individuals. I think creativity for some can be as much a burden as it can be a gift. And certainly that's true in organizations. To have really creative people in organizations, even when they say they want it, frequently don't. And to be surrounded by creative people can be highly problematic and highly difficult. I like creative people, but I like them in their place and I like them in small doses.
Creative Genius was presented by Ian Peacock. The producer was Pamela Rutherford.